Joining us now is Mark Scribner. He is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Mark, good morning and welcome to Mornings on the Mall. How are you?
Morning. Thank you for having me. I'm great. How are you?
Oh, fantastic. Let's talk about this idea that the administration is floating to want to sell off some assets around the United States, including Reagan National and Dulles Airports, the Washington Aqueduct, and the George Washington Memorial Parkway and the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. A lot of questions here. The first question being, how would this be done? I mean, who would buy something like this?
Well, I think it's important to note that those were just examples the administration listed of possible federal assets that might be ripe for federal divestiture. And while some have suggested that the administration may be aiming to combine this with their planned expansion of the airport privatization pilot program, so allowing the private sector to take control of those assets, I don't think that's really what they're suggesting. Really what they're looking at is that in the Washington area, we have some very strange asset ownership relationships. And by that, I mean we have the federal government owning urban highways like Baltimore-Washington and George Washington Parkways. And those are managed by the National Park Service, which is a very odd arrangement. If you look around the rest of the country, those urban highways that are part of the national highway system are generally owned by the states. They're not owned by the feds, and they're certainly not managed by the Park Service. Same thing with airports. What we have in with Reagan National and Dulles looks a lot more like what we see in Canada, where the federal government owns the land, and then the airport providers pay lease payments to the federal government. In the rest of the country, the land that airports sit on is owned by the local airport authorities. So really what I think they were doing is pointing out the oddities in the Washington region that are sort of legacy items, and they exist in large part because the seat of federal power is here, and there's a lot of weird things that go along with that.
It's an oddity, but are there upsides, downsides? How do you weigh it by privatizing DCA and Dulles, for instance?
Well, I don't know if you necessarily, if those would be the best airports you'd want to privatize, particularly if you look at how those airports interact. I mean, the federal government has a perimeter restriction around Reagan National, which is designed to boost the attractiveness of Dulles because Reagan National is much more attractive for a lot of people, particularly in Washington, D.C. So they actually reduce the competitiveness of Reagan National to prop up Dulles flights. So I think the odd relationship that goes between the federal government and those airports do not make them particularly attractive to the private sector. As far as how a divestiture would go, I suspect what they would do is hope that the states and locals. So in the case of Baltimore-Washington, they would want to look at Maryland to perhaps issue bonds and purchase that highway segment. And in the case of Reagan National or George Washington Parkways or Dulles, they would want Virginia to look at issuing bonds to purchase that they would pay off over time. But, of course, those communities and the states would want to be careful to not end up like a situation as Canada has found itself in, where the lease payments to the federal government can be very high, and that could be true of any bond payments that they'd be making in an asset transfer,
yep.
And that could increase the cost of travel to those airports.
And Mark, I know you follow infrastructure really closely. What did you think of the president's plan yesterday, $200 billion in order to leverage its way to $1.5 trillion in overall infrastructure spending, portions of it being used in that way, others just grants for rural areas?
Well, I'm skeptical of the ability of them to leverage that $200 billion over 10 years into up to, according to President Trump, $1.7 trillion in total investment. But in large part, what they propose to do is combine half of that $200 billion, which they say is an incentive grants program, and that means there's a 20% match from the federal government. That means 80%. Would come from the states or the private sector. But that also means you would be able to use some of these federal credit instruments, which under this plan $14 billion of that $200 billion would be used to support TIFIA and WIFIA and these credit assistance programs, and that is where most of that leverage comes into play. So lending out this money or backing loans that would then be used, there would be the multiplier effect there. So that's where a lot of that speculation, that projection of an additional $1.5 trillion in investment comes from. It's leveraging those credit programs that would be enhanced under this plan.
What do you think about the idea that apparently Republicans are weighing whether to raise the federal gas tax? It has not been raised since 1993, and they're talking about raising it as a way to pay for infrastructure.
Right, and that has support from certainly from the infrastructure industry. The Chamber of Commerce is the major proponent of raising the federal gas tax, and there's some logic to it. Inflation has eroded the buying power of the federal gas tax, but I think the main problem with that approach is that it ignores the future, and it really doesn't solve the underlying problem. We're going to much more fuel efficient vehicles. Eventually, we're going to have the vehicle fleet electrify. And if that happens, well, the gas tax just doesn't serve much of a purpose, at least if the purpose is paying for roads. So I think they need to start looking at alternatives. And to this plan's credit, one thing they do look at is lifting federal restrictions on states tolling their own interstate segments. So if states are able to use some of these new revenue collection mechanisms and also the financing instruments that can go along with those, perhaps we would see states gradually transition away from the need for these federal highway grant dollars and towards more sustainable local revenue collection.
Yeah, and I look at that and I think of, boy, anytime I go into Manhattan and I travel in and out of Manhattan, you pay $15, $18 to cross a bridge one way. They are making money hand over fist, yet they don't have money to maintain the bridges. My question then is, well, where is the money going? I really have to question where the money goes for some of these things. So there's that idea, but there's also this VMT, which Oregon and California have pilot programs on for vehicle miles traveled. And you have the option to pay the miles you travel and then get a rebate on the gas tax.
Right. And I think that's where eventually we'll be going, is something like a VMT fee. And it makes sense. It's arguably the fairest way you could charge for roads, because you're really only charging people for what you use then. And you could also then do some interesting things with congestion pricing. So you can hopefully use pricing to reduce congestion, yeah, which is a lot less costlier than expanding highways, which, if they're left unpriced, will likely in the future just become congested again.
Yeah.
So I think we're moving towards road pricing, but we're probably still at least a decade away before you're going to see large-scale trial programs throughout the United States, not just in some of those western states.
Letting the government track exactly how many miles I use my car for each year makes me want to jump out a window. But at any rate, Mark, thank you. Mark Scribner, really appreciate you stopping by from the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.